just a second to join. Got a number of people joining right now, so sit tight for just a second and we will get started here in just a moment. So much for joining us this evening. We are thrilled to have you all here. We had a tremendous response and a lot of interest in this webinar. So hopefully this is helpful. We are excited again to have you here. This is the first time that we're doing this legislative update webinar. We've got a bunch of information to cover, so we are going to dive right in here. Before we get started, we're going to do some introductions. I think it's helpful to put names with faces. And since we are a brand new state office, we're going to do just a quick introduction so that you can see who we are and get a sense for what we do in the office, so you know who you're interacting with when you come to us. My name is Erin Ryder. I'm the director of the HOA Ombudsman Office, so I oversee all of the activities that happen here in the office. Chris, you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm Chris Binning. I'm the staff attorney at the office. So most people interact with me when we're doing advisory opinions. I also go out and do training for associations and homeowners.
Great. And Amy, you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Amy Pueller. I'm the legal assistant here. I handle the intake interviews, answer phones, and emails.
Great. We also have on the webinar with us our legislative intern, Ben Dworak. He's going to be helping us with questions today, as well as the communications director for the Department of Commerce, Melanie Hall. So she's helping us run the webinar here. Okay, so some quick logistics for how we're going to do this. There are a lot of people on this webinar. I expect we're going to see, well, the numbers are still climbing. So we have a lot of people joining us, which means that the way we're going to do this is we're going to run through each section, and at the end of each section, we'll take some questions related to that section. Because of the number of people, we're probably not going to be able to answer every question that comes in. But you should be able to see the questions that come in through the Q&A function at the bottom of the screen. If you see a question that is relevant and similar to one that you have, click on the little like button and that will upvote the question. So we're going to prioritize those because it means that more people are interested in that topic. So Chris is going to help us with questions. Chris and Ben here are going to help us with questions. And we're going to get to as many as we can, but just logistically, that's how we're going to do it. If we don't get to your specific question, feel free to reach out to the office separately and we are more than happy to discuss it with you. We just may be a little bit limited on time when we've got, I don't know, 300 people already who have joined this. Also, for any attorneys who have joined, if you have not already given us your bar number and you would like CLE credit, please put that in the chat or the Q&A and we'll make sure to include that when we submit that to the bar. Okay, let's get into this. So here's what we're going to talk about today. Instead of going bill by bill, we're going to break this down by topic. Each slide will also list the bill number. So if you want more information on the on what we're talking about, you can have the bill number there. You can go look that up yourself. We're not going to get to every legislative change that was made in this last general session in 2026. We're going to highlight the things that we think are the most consequential for this group. If you again, want more information, have additional questions, don't hesitate to reach out to us. But these are the topics that we're going to go through. Okay, let's get into registration requirements. Now, I think almost everybody hopefully knows that every HOA in the state of Utah is required to register with our office. And as of 2025, is also required to renew that registration annually. We're going to get into renewals later this summer. We're not going to have any of those happen until the fall. So, we're not really going to answer any questions about renewals yet. But just so you know, that's background for what we're getting into here. So, what are the changes made with regard to registrations? First is contact information. There were a lot of concerns expressed to our office about privacy, particularly privacy for board members who had to put things like a physical mailing address on the registry. And we understand that. We realized we don't actually need those physical addresses. We don't use them for anything. They're not really there. The point of the registry, one of the main purposes, is to provide a way for homeowners to contact their board members. So we went to the legislature and said, we don't need the physical address. We know that people have privacy concerns. How about if we remove that requirement? And the legislature said, yeah, that sounds great. So what is going to be required going forward? the board chair or the president is going to still be required to put in their name, phone number, and an email address if applicable. Each board member, however, is only required to put in their name. They can put in a phone number and an email address if they want, but they're not required to. Managers, if you have a manager for your association, they'll be required to put in their contact information as well. And then the information for the payoff contact, which helps with closings for real estate transactions, that information is the same. So the main change here is that a physical address is no longer required for anybody. And the board president has to put in their primary contact information. Board members put in their name, and they can put additional contact information if they want. There's also going to be a change here in terms of reinvestment fees and transfer fees. Now, transfer fees have a name change. They're now called administrative setup fees. We're going to get into that in a second. But the point here with the registry is that going forward on any registration, the association will have to mark whether or not it charges a reinvestment fee or an administrative setup fee. You won't have to say the amount of what that fee is. It's just basically going to be a yes or no box that you check that says whether or not you charge one. So, real estate professionals, this is going to be really helpful for you guys to know ahead of time if there's an association that charges one of these fees. Board members, make sure that you know this information, managers, and that this is updated on the registry when you make any updates or renew your registration. Okay, let's take questions there for a second before we get into the next section. Chris, do we have any questions?
We do not at this point.
Great. I'm explaining this really well, and all of you are perfectly understanding me, and that is a real success. So we're going to move right into the declaration and rules. Now, I want to clarify there are two statutes that govern HOAs in the state of Utah. There's the
Erin,
Condominium Ownership Act and the
sorry,
Community
Erin, it's
Association Act.
Melanie. Can I
Oh,
pause you
yes.
for a moment? I just need to remind everyone that raising your hand will not answer the question. You need to put questions in the Q&A located in the bottom of the tool. Again, just a reminder, please use the Q&A tool. We will not be responding to raised hands. Thank you.
And Aaron, we just did get a question on the reinvestment fees real quick. Does an association have to go in and click the reinvestment fee box if they've already registered?
So this is a this is all of these laws for the most part take effect on May 6th, 2026. So in about a month here, which is why we're doing this now. So any update to your registration or when you go in to renew your registration, that's when those changes will take effect. So yes, going forward, you will have to list that even if you've already registered with our office. Okay, anything else, Chris? Are we good to move forward?
That's a later one. Oh, we do have one. Can a board adopt a policy to list the management company's info as the board's contact info?
That's a great question. We've actually issued an advisory opinion on this. You can go look at that on our website. The idea here is that this has to be a way that for the board member to be contacted, so or the board president. So that board president can designate whatever they want to be in there, but it has to be something that they ultimately are going to be able to see and to respond to. So so that's the requirement. But that's also why we have the manager section, because if you have a manager, you can also list the manager's contact information there. And you can do that in a number of ways, right? If you have a Gmail account that's hoaboardpresident@gmail.com, that's perfectly sufficient. It just has to be something that allows you to be contacted by someone in your association. Okay. Let's move into declarations or CC&Rs and rules. So again, two statutes that govern HOAs. There's the Condo Act and the Community Association Act. As we go through the rest of this discussion, some changes are going to apply to both statutes. Some are only going to apply to one. It's important because they're not identical. So the one that applies to you is primarily going to be whatever's in your CC&Rs. And so we're going to try and call out here when things apply to differently to the different statutes. On that point, the first question or the first thing we're getting into is when does each act apply? This was an interesting issue that we started to come across as we were doing our advisory opinions. It wasn't always terribly clear which statute should apply to an association. So, what has changed? Essentially, your declaration or your CC&Rs should say which statute applies to that association. So, something along the lines of this association is subject to the Condominium Ownership Act, something like that. If your CC&Rs are silent, meaning they don't state one of those statutes, then we're going to look at the plat and to see whether or not the plat is designated as a condominium. If so, we'll apply the Condominium Ownership Act. If the plat is not designated as a condominium, then the Community Association Act applies. So essentially, the default is the Community Association Act, unless it's very clearly identified as a condominium project, either in the CC&Rs or the plat. So hopefully that's going to eliminate a lot of the confusion around which statute applies. Okay, second clarification here. A few months ago, we issued an advisory opinion 2025-10, if you want to go read this. The issue here was, can the CC&Rs restrict certain things in a community that the rules are not allowed to restrict? And there was confusion about what the law actually said. The way that we came down in this opinion is that there are certain provisions, certain restrictions that cannot be imposed by an association either in the CC&Rs or the rules. But all of the language for that was in the section of code that dealt specifically with rules. So there's no real legislative change here. There's no real substantive change. The change that's happening here is that the legislature took all of the sections, all the provisions in that rule section that they wanted to apply to CC&Rs, and they duplicated them in the section on CC&Rs. So, board members, we're going to encourage you to talk to your attorneys about this and managers to make sure you know exactly what is required here. The point again is that there's no real significant legal change. It's just a clarification that there are certain things that an association cannot do either in its CC&Rs or in its rules. And that's the important thing here. Now, there are some new restrictions on what a condo association can prohibit. So, going forward, a condo association cannot prohibit reasonable activity within the confines of the unit, or restrictions on unit interiors. It also cannot prohibit transfers of units or require an approval before a transfer of a unit. And if a condo has driveways that are individual to each unit, you cannot prohibit basketball standards on driveways that abut a public street. Again, we're going to refer you to your attorney if you have specific questions on your association, but those were some new restrictions added in. Those are already in the Community Association Act. The legislature just brought them over into the Condo Act as well. Okay, one note on parking here. We've issued a couple of advisory opinions on parking, so I want to clarify this. The rule with parking is that an HOA cannot restrict an individual from parking on their driveway unless the vehicle in question is one of the following. And you can see this in the bottom left corner of the slide. Those first three bullet points were already code. They were enacted last year in 2025. The key here is that each one of these has a statutory definition, right? So you may think as a board that something is a recreational vehicle trailer. But if it's not actually within the statutory definition of what a recreational vehicle trailer is, it doesn't matter. You can't restrict it. So the change is in the bullet points in bold, the trailers, off-highway vehicles, special mobile equipment, and motorboats. Those are new additions to what an association can restrict on a driveway. Again, they all have statutory definitions, so you're going to want to make sure that that you work with your attorney, work with your managers, so that everybody knows what actually what an association can prohibit and when they can't. Okay, and then the last thing here with CC&Rs and rules, concerns about wildfires. If an association is in a designated wildland urban interface area, again, that's a statutory definition, then a community association cannot prohibit in their rules a lot owner from removing vegetation from their lot if you're within that area. So again, boards, managers, you'll want to talk to your attorneys to see if this applies to your specific association. But essentially, the idea here is that let's say you live in an area that's within one of these wildland urban interface areas, and you have a beautiful grassy meadow, and you want to preserve the character of the community by requiring everyone to preserve that meadow. That's okay in the common areas, but if a homeowner is concerned about wildfire risk and wants to remove the grassy area from their individual lot, you cannot prohibit them from doing that. That's the general idea here. Now, this law only applies to the Community Association Act, not the Condo Act. So, again, you'll want to talk to your attorney to see whether or not this applies to you. Okay, Chris, any questions for CC&Rs and rules?
Yeah, we have a couple, largely about vehicles. So a couple of them kind of tied it together. What about unlicensed vehicles? And what if the vehicles are leaking fluid or something like that on the driveway?
So the statutes do say do have terms about operable vehicles. So again, I'm gonna encourage you to talk to your attorney about this for specifics. But generally speaking, you can prohibit or you can require that the vehicle is operable. Now, operable has to be within its designated structure. So a trailer is an operable vehicle because you can attach it to the back of a car and drive off with it, right? That is an operable vehicle. A vehicle that's up on cinder blocks may not be operable. And so anyway, I would again encourage you to talk to your attorney, but there is some language in the code about restrictions on operable vehicles. What else, Chris?
Yeah, so we have one. Are we interpreting the new restrictions in the law as they apply to declarations retroactively?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't have a great answer on that yet. We're still evaluating that. And so, if you want to talk about specifics, come talk to us, but we're looking into that.
And then one final quick question on vehicles. Can a vehicle park sideways on a driveway because the length of the driveway will not fit the vehicle?
That's a great question. The code doesn't really say anything about vehicles parked sideways or about how the vehicle is parked on the driveway. So as long as it's a vehicle that is allowed on a driveway, then probably. But again, I'm going to encourage you to talk to your attorney about that. Okay. Let's talk about budgets for a second here. There are two main changes to budgets, one to the Condo Act and one to the Community Association Act, and they're kind of related. So first for the Condo Act. One of the challenges with having two sections of code that govern HOAs is that not every change makes it into both sections, even if that's the legislative intent. That's what happened here. In the Community Association Act, there's a statutory requirement that a board adopts a budget every year and presents it to the members. Until now, there was no such requirement in the Condo Act. And so not a lot of statutory clarification around what an association had to do with regard to a budget, which meant it deferred entirely to the governing documents. Going forward, however, that's going to change. So the language that's now in the Condo Act is basically a carbon copy of what's in the Community Association Act. And the way it works is that the board or the management committee prepares and adopts an annual budget at least once a year. That adopted budget is then presented to the members at a meeting. And the members, the unit owners, have 45 days from the date of that meeting to disapprove the budget. If the budget is disapproved, or for some reason, if there's no budget adopted, then it will default to the prior budget until the management committee prepares and adopts a new one. Now let's talk about what this means. Homeowners do not have an approval right over the budget. The board has the authority to adopt the budget and then they present it to the owners. If the owners are concerned about the budget or want something to change, they need to call a special meeting to disapprove of the budget. So it's a disapproval right, it's not an approval right. So there's a difference there on how that works. Additionally, one other change that was made in the code this year is that if this budget, this disapproval right, excuse me, now exists even during the period of administrative control. So if a developer is in charge of a community, and presents a budget to the members. The members have this same disapproval right. In the Community Association Act, that was not the case. This was a change made this year, and it was made both in the Condo Act and in the Community Association Act. So just know that disapproval right exists pretty much at all times. In order to disapprove, you have to get at least 51% of all the voting interests, again at a special meeting, and it has to be called within 45 days of the budget being adopted and presented. So, what changed in the Community Association Act? Again, that disapproval right during the period of administrative control, that was one of those changes. And then the other change made here is that there was some confusion around what would happen if a board just didn't adopt a budget. And so there was a change made to say if the budget is disapproved by the members or not adopted by the board at all, then you default to the prior year budget. And this is just to provide some stability and some clarification. The board is supposed to adopt a new budget every year, but if for some reason they don't, then you default to the prior budget. Okay, any questions on budgets, Chris?
Yep. So we have one. Can you please clarify, is it the board that approves the budget and the members can then ask for a meeting if they disapprove of the budget?
That's right. Yeah, so it's a special meeting that the members call under the special meeting requirements of the governing documents. And at that meeting, you take a vote on whether or not you want to disapprove of the budget.
Okay. And then a couple more on budgets. Since the budget may change the fee schedule, does this require a 15-day notice and the right to be heard in the board meeting before?
That's a good question. If it implicates the fee schedule, then you'd want to make sure you're following any fee schedule rules as well.
And what does the disapproval right get owners other than the ability to file their disapproval?
So it basically terminates the budget. It kicks it out. So if you vote to disapprove the budget, it's gone, and you default to the prior year budget until the board comes up with a new budget.
And then we have several related to disapprovals. So once, let me see, are there, so the biggest question is how far back can you go for a budget to be collected? And if the, if it's disapproved, what happens?
So we're just talking about the budget that's presented for that's adopted and presented for the current year. So let's say your board just adopted and presented the 2026 budget. If the members feel for some reason that that budget is insufficient, they can call a special meeting within 45 days of the budget being presented and then vote to disapprove the budget, in which case you default just to the previous budget that you had, which is most likely last year's budget. And then you just continue with last year's budget until there's a new budget adopted.
And then there's one question about reserves. I think there were some changes on that, though, so we can address that in a little bit.
Homeowners also have a disapproval right over the reserve line item itself. That's in addition to the disapproval right over the budget as an entirety. So the homeowners could decide to disapprove of just the reserve line item or the budget in its entirety, either one.
Okay.
Let's go on to everybody's favorite topic, transfer fees, reinvestment fees, and reserves. Let's talk about this here. All right, I mentioned earlier at the beginning of this that transfer fees are now administrative setup fees. So the reason for this is that in code, there were essentially two different types of transfer fees. There was a private transfer fee that's a recorded covenant against a property. And then there was the transfer fee in the real estate context where when you, it was basically an administrative setup fee, which is why we've now gone to that definition. So what is this? It's a fee, a charge, or a payment that's related to the sale of real property and imposed on a buyer or seller by the association or someone like a manager. Now, there's a strict use for this. This administrative setup fee is void and unenforceable unless it is used only to pay expenses related to the transfer of real property. And the language in italics there of real property, that was an addition in the 2026 session. So these fees can only be used to pay for the expenses related to the transfer of real property. That's it. Anything else, it's void and unenforceable. If a manager is collecting the administrative setup fee on behalf of the association, they have to provide an annual accounting of all fees collected that year, and they have to provide that report to the association by December 31st of every year. So, managers, this is really important for you to know so that you stay in compliance with this. Board members, also really important for you to know so that you know to be looking for this report and asking for it from your managers. Okay, so, and then real estate professionals, as we mentioned, important to know that this is the name that you should be looking for on a closing statement when it comes to these fees. Now, let's talk for a second about the other type of transfer fee. So, again, The other transfer fee, which is still the statutory language, it's a recorded covenant against the property. Oftentimes, you'll see this as like a 1% charge that shows up on a closing statement, and it's something that's recorded against the property. These private transfer fees were actually made illegal in Utah in about 2010, and then there were some updates made to the code in 2024. But there have been some issues with these private transfer fees being re resurrected over the last year or so. So this bill, SB 196, was the legislature's attempt to try and address that. Going forward, what this means is that unless, let's see, a notice of transfer fee covenant that's recorded when the underlying covenant is unenforceable is now a wrongful lien under Utah law. That creates a right of action for the person against whom it is recorded. If it is, that also means that the covenant itself is invalid. Okay, so this is really important. What this means, real estate professionals, is that if you see a private transfer fee on a closing statement in one of your real estate transactions, you might want to contact an attorney. Also, probably not a bad idea if you're representing a seller to check with the county to see if these have been recorded, if one of these covenants has been recorded before you list the property for sale. Because depending on how it is recorded, if there are certain things that have happened, it might be a wrongful lien, in which case the covenant would be unenforceable. So, again, consult with an attorney if you encounter one of these, but worth knowing because these do pop up in the real estate context. Okay, let's talk about reinvestment fees. We're gonna some quick definition changes in the code. The first is this idea of capital-intensive infrastructure maintenance. Now, if you think about it, a reinvestment fee is supposed to provide resources for infrastructure and capital needs. This is different than that administrative setup fee, which is essentially intended to be an administrative fee to cover the administrative costs of bringing a new homeowner into the community. Reinvestment fees are there to provide resources for capital, for common areas, and for infrastructure needs. This definition of capital-intensive infrastructure maintenance accounts for some of that. So that's infrastructure with a useful life of more than 5 years after construction. It needs periodic replacement or major rehabilitation and requires advanced funding through reserves or special assessments. So we're talking things like roads, pools, roofs, things like that. We're not talking about landscaping, signage, fencing, anything like that. The legislature also created a new category of association. It's called a low amenity association. What is this? It's an association made up of single, detached single family homes that does not provide capital intensive infrastructure maintenance to the members. So essentially, this is an HOA where you have detached single family homes, and really all the association does is provide landscaping or something along those lines. Maybe you have a sign out in front of your community. We're going to get into why this matters in a second. And then a large master plan development. This is not a new change in the statute, but I want to highlight it because it matters for our next slide. A large master plan development is a development of at least 500 acres or 500 units, and it includes a commitment to fund, construct, or develop any of these things we've been talking about: infrastructure, facilities, programming, other types of amenities. If you think about a place like Daybreak, right? All of Daybreak, that's a large master plan development. It's a huge community. They have a ton of amenities, facilities, programming, infrastructure, all sorts of things. That's a large master plan development. Why does this matter? It matters because the amount you can charge in a reinvestment fee depends on what type of association you are. If you're a low amenity association, you can only charge up to 0.25% as a reinvestment fee. If you are a large master plan development, there's no cap on the amount that you can charge for a reinvestment fee. Everybody else has a cap of 0.5%. That 0.5% was already in code. So what we're doing here is we're basically saying low amenity associations don't need the 0.5%. You get 0.25%. Large master plan developments, there are a lot of things happening there. We're not going to put a cap on that. Everybody else gets the 0.5%. So again, real estate professionals, important for you to know as you're looking at these reinvestment fees with your clients, managers, boards, right? Making sure you've got the right amount, that you're charging the right amount, because anything over that cap would not be enforceable. Another requirement: at least 50% of that reserve fee has to go into reserves from now on, into your reserve funds. There is an exception here for large master plan developments. Large master plan developments are not subject to this, but everybody else, low amenity associations and everybody else, at least 50% of that reinvestment fee has to go into reserve funds. Again, boards, managers, important to make sure that your communities are compliant with this. Okay, and then the last change here. We only deal with state law issues in our office, but there were some changes made by put out by Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae that are important enough that we wanted to mention them. First of all, this only applies to condominium associations. The concern here, if you all were familiar with the Surfside condo in Florida that collapsed a few years ago, the issue there was an underfunded HOA where the members had were not approving a special assessment. They were not able to raise assessments enough to deal with the deferred maintenance in the building, and eventually the building just collapsed. So there's now concern among lenders about underfunded reserves. And what that means is that they're more carefully scrutinizing any loans before they back it. So what does that mean for boards and for condominium associations? It means if you have a reserve study, which you are supposed to have, you have to go with the highest recommended reserve allocation from that reserve study. You can't use the baseline funding. You have to go with the highest recommended amount from the reserve study. It also means that before, according to these lenders, they were only looking to see if you were putting 10% of your annual assessments into reserves. Now they're looking to see if it's at least 15%. Now, what does this mean? Utah state law does not impose this requirement in and of itself. This is a lender requirement from Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. What it means, though, is that if you are not compliant with this, you could be at risk for your association losing FHA funding status, which means that a homeowner may not be able to use an FHA loan to buy into the community. And it can have other implications on whether or not loans can be backed by these associations. There are some additional insurance requirements included in these. We're not going to get into those here, but we very much encourage you to talk to your brokers and to make sure you understand what those new insurance requirements are. So again, boards, managers, important to make sure that you're looking at that 15% and that highest recommended reserve amount. And then real estate professionals, if you are working with a seller or a buyer, you'll want to make sure that you're looking for this. The implications here could be that if Freddie Mac or Fannie Mae decide that they won't back a loan into one of these communities, it could leave a seller in a position where they're only able to sell to a cash buyer. And that can be a big problem, as you can imagine. So you'll want to make sure that you're looking at this. Okay, Chris, any questions on administrative setup fees, reinvestment fees, or the lender requirements?
So we have a number of people have asked, can you give examples of administrative setup fees, reinvestment fees, kind of what the differences are and examples of them?
So, administrative setup fees, let's say that you live in an association that has a pool or that has a clubhouse or something like that. You have key fobs that need to get in and out. You have online portals. There's a cost associated with bringing a new homeowner online that, to get them all the stuff that they need to be part of the community. Those things usually come about in administrative setup fees. That's different than a reinvestment fee, which is saying, okay, we're going to charge 0.25 or 0.5% of the cost, the price on the home, and that's going to go into an amount set aside here, reserves for, the upcoming elevator repair that we need to do, or the upcoming road maintenance that we need to do, something along those lines. So reinvestment fees are for the big capital issues, the stuff that you put into your reserves. Administrative setup fees are the administrative costs of bringing a new homeowner online. Now, I do want to say one thing with this. What if you see something mislabeled on a closing statement? That is an interesting area that could have some potential implications. The legislature has been pretty clear about what these fees are intended to do and what they're not intended to do. So, if you see especially now where those private transfer fees are illegal, if a closing statement were to come across and list something as a transfer fee, that could potentially be void and unenforceable because transfer fees are illegal. So, you managers, make sure that you list things the right way. If you list something as an administrative setup fee that's actually a reinvestment fee, you might be way overcharging for that administrative setup fee, which could again cause problems. So it's important for managers to be working with attorneys and boards to make sure that these fees are labeled correctly, because that could actually matter quite a bit in terms of their enforceability. What else, Chris?
Okay, so a couple along the same line. Is there a specific use required for reinvestment fees, and is there a way to challenge them to basically have to demonstrate what that use is?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. We have not encountered that yet as an office. But theoretically, yes, if you felt like a fee was improperly charged, then someone could potentially challenge that.
Okay. And we have a lot of other questions, but due to time, some of them I think we'll direct to our office.
Okay. Yeah, any specific instances, feel free to reach out to us, and we're happy to talk through those. And if we have time at the end, we can certainly come back to this. All right, let's talk about property tax assessment of common areas. We'll just go over this really quickly here. The idea here is that everyone in the community owns the common area. They own a proportional share of the common area. And so this is just a change to the way the common area is taxed. Instead of taxing it as a separate entity, at the association level, now the county assessor is going to include the value of the common area proportionally with your home. So essentially, the value of the common area is spread across all lots and units proportionally. And again, it's not assessed at the association level. So this may create a change in the way you see your property being valued for tax purposes. If you have questions about this, talk with an attorney, talk with a certified public accountant, a tax accountant, or with your county assessor's office directly. Any questions on that?
No.
Okay, we'll move on to the next thing. Let's talk about records access. We get a lot of questions about records. This is a very frequent topic that comes up with in our advisory opinion. So there are two main changes here. The first is deadlines. Excuse me. Previously, there have been a couple changes in code over time. Initially, it was 5 days to respond to a records request, and then on the sixth day, the homeowner could basically go after the association for a penalty. $25 a day for not providing the documents. Then the legislature changed that to 2 weeks to respond to a records request. But they left the 6-day penalty in there, which didn't make a whole lot of sense. So now we've clarified it. And now the rule is an association or the manager acting on behalf of the association has 10 business days to respond to a records request. And then the $25 per day penalty starts on the 11th business day. So that's the rule. So you got 10 business days to respond to the request. On the 11th day, the penalty is applicable. This applies to both the Community Association Act and the Condo Act. A reminder here, too, that associations and managers cannot charge owners for the cost of an electronic document delivery. That includes an online portal. You can charge for physical copies. The limits here are at the bottom of the screen, but you cannot charge for electronic document delivery. And the other thing I want to say here, real estate professionals know this deadline ahead of time. If you are helping a seller or a buyer, the seller is the one that needs to request these documents from the association or the manager, because they are the one that has the legal right to do that. And then the seller has to provide them to the buyer. And so you need to know this 10 business day window. It's a runway of time that you've got to account for before closing. So if you request documents the day before closing, you may not get them, because technically the association has up to 10 business days to respond. Okay, the other change made here is a question of what is the property of the association. So all association records and documents are property of the association. Additionally, the funds that are held in an association account, also property of the association. What does this mean? This means, let's say that the manager is storing the records of the association. Pretty common, makes a lot of sense for a lot of reasons. It's still the property of the association, even if the manager is storing those documents. Same thing with the funds that are held in a bank account. If the manager is listed as as the agent on the bank account, that's fine, but the funds in the account are still the property of the association. Where does this become important? Let's say that the contract is terminated for some reason and the association decides to hire a different manager. If the association requests those documents, they have to be handed over immediately. This applies even if there's a dispute between the association and the third party, like the manager, or again during a transition to new management. So, managers, important to know if that record, that those records are the property of the association, those funds are the property of the association. Boards, also helpful for you to know when you make that request. Okay, any questions on records?
Yeah, we got a few. One is related to charging for records. There's actually a few tying to this. Are real estate professionals required to pay for CC&Rs and information required under the REPC?
This is great. A great point of clarification. State law only requires that the buyer be provided with a couple of things. They have to be provided with the recorded documents, so that would be the CC&Rs or, anything that's recorded with the county. They also have to be provided with a link to the HOA Ombudsman website. I don't know why I did not request that, but that's there in state code. So by law, that is what a buyer is entitled to. Now, by contract, they are entitled to more. So under the REPC contract, there's a list of standard seller disclosures. That is a contractual right between the buyer and the seller, but it is not necessarily a state statute right. What does that mean? It means that the seller, by virtue of being the homeowner in the association, has all the legal right to ask for those records from the association because that's how the state code looks at it. The homeowner has the right to ask for the documents. The buyer is not yet the homeowner, so they don't have the same standing to make that request that the seller does. So a buyer could go directly to a manager or to an association, but they don't have the same standing that the seller does. The best way to do it is to get the seller to request the documents, and then the seller provides them to the buyer, which fulfills the requirements under the contract. Okay, what else?
Okay. Associations, managers, and council for associations routinely ask for and are granted extensions in responding to record requests by owners. Do we interpret the penalty starting on the 11th day as invalidating agreed upon extensions?
Think so. We've never had that issue come before our office, but I would think that if there was an agreed extension between the parties, that would probably be sufficient.
Is there any, are boards required to provide owners with board meeting minutes and financials with any regularity?
Yeah, so the code actually lists out a whole bunch of things that owners are entitled to request. And so I'm going to point you to the code to go look at that list because it's too long to get into here. But essentially, they have the right to ask for documents of the association. So that would include meeting minutes, that would include financial statements, basic financial statements, that would include the budget, the reserve analysis, things like that. But again, I'll point you to the code for the specific and the complete list there.
Okay. And then the last one on the kind of new changes. Are there any penalties if a management company does not turn over information to a new management company?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know. We haven't gotten into it yet. What it does is it creates a claim for the so that the association can bring against the manager.
Okay.
Great. All right, so we're going to show you a few additional resources that are that we've been working on here in the Department of Commerce to help you all out. The first is our website. We're very excited about this. If you go to our website, hoa.utah.gov, or you can see it up here at the top too, you can get to it, commerce.utah.gov/hoa, and you go to resources and education. It's going to take you to this page. One of our statutory mandates is that we provide, well, let's see, can you guys see this? Okay. One of the requirements is that we provide education and resources to the public. So we're currently building this out right now. If you go here, a couple things I want to show you. First of all, real estate professionals and actually managers, well, really this applies to everybody. We've created a home buyer checklist. So if you are buying in an HOA, if you have a client who's buying in an HOA, you can come here and you can download a copy, a PDF copy of this checklist, and take it with you as you're looking at different homes. We've got some information listed in here about understanding what you're buying, understanding a master plan development and how those work. We've got some notes about the Rep C. You'll see notes on financing. So again, we're talking about our Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac stuff right here. And then the rest of it is just a whole bunch of questions that a homeowner should consider before they buy in an HOA. We've got questions about structure and governance. We've got questions about finances, dues, special assessments, reserves. Here are administrative setup fees and our reinvestment fees. We've got questions in here about rules, rental restrictions, making sure the rules fit your lifestyle, the physical property. For example, you become a joint owner along with all the other owners in the common areas. So, should you get a home inspection on a clubhouse? Should you have a structural engineer look at a pool? Because you're going to be on the hook for paying for that as a part owner in the community. So maybe it's worth having someone look at it. Just checking out the community in general. And then down here, we have information on the documents that the seller's required to provide. So, all the information that I just shared, we have all of that written here. Tips for getting documents in a real estate transaction. So you can come and you can download this. You can look at it here. You can also get an online version. This is also accessible and you can come down as interactive. So you can go in and check these off when you've looked at each question and use that as a resource. All right, what else do we have on here? We also have a section for statutes and legislation. So we've got all of the HOA related statutes listed here. Every year we'll post legislative updates. When we finish this webinar tonight, we'll post the video right here on our website so you can come back and review it if helpful. And then we'll go through and these are all the bills that we've been talking about tonight. What if you don't know which statute applies to you? Well, we have this little thing here on our website that can walk you through which one likely applies. This is not legal advice. It is not, you're still going to want to talk to an attorney to make sure that, and look at your CC&Rs to make sure you know exactly, but this can give you some guidance if you're wondering which statute applies to you. That matters because we've split the resources down here into condo resources and community association resources. We're going to build this out. We're just getting started on this, so check back often. But we're going to break it into categories: living in a condo association, running a condo association for board members, working with a condo association. You can go and check this out. We have it broken out into different topics. You can come in and look at each one of these. And when you click into one, it'll give you a summary of what that particular topic is. Eventually, we'll tie this to other sections as well, right? Related topics. We've got the related statutes that we reference here. And then any resources that we have created, training slides that you can use in an annual meeting, handouts that you can provide to your community, the statutes that you should know, and the relevant documents, governing documents that usually talk about whatever it is that we're looking at here. So you can come in and look at each one of these. We also have some areas where we tie in to other state resources. So if you're looking at bids and contracts, you want to hire a contractor to come do some work. We've got information here from the Division of Professional Licensure and the Division of Consumer Protection to make sure that you're not getting scammed. So any resources like that, other state resources, we're going to try and provide here as well. If you don't like the way this is laid out, you just want to see a list of topics, you can come back here and you can browse by topic. So as you can see, we only have through the B's done right now. We're working on it, but it does the same thing. It takes you to the same place and shows you the same information. So that's our website. We're constantly updating this. Come back and check frequently, and we can show you that information. Then the next thing that I want to provide, and give me a second here to log into it. It just logged me out. Okay, here we go. There's a new well, actually, before I move on, any questions on the website, Chris?
No.
The next thing I want to show you oh, is the My Utah portal. The state of Utah just put this out. This is a fantastic tool. Everybody should register for this, whether or not you live in an association. This is essentially a one-stop shop for any government service, state government service that you might need. So you can log in, you create your own account, you can get a birth certificate, a death certificate for a family member, you can file your Utah income taxes, you can find your legislative representatives, hunting and fishing licenses, immunization records, you can connect with the DMV for a vehicle registration, you can look for jobs, get unemployment. All of that is in the same place. They also just barely added homeowners association services. So, if you go in here, this will take you to our website, just exactly where we were a second ago. You can request an advisory opinion. This will take you directly to that application. And let's say you live in an association. Well, you can add that to your list, and you can favorite the association. You can basically subscribe to it. You come down here, and it'll show you all the registration information for that association. It'll show you whether or not it's an active registration. You click on favorite this association, and then it will show up here in your favorited HOAs. You can again request an advisory opinion here. Eventually, the goal is that you basically subscribe to your HOA. We can send out news alerts and different things directly through this portal to anyone who has subscribed to their HOA. You can favorite up to, I think, 9 or 10 HOAs. So let's say you have parents who live in an association, you have kids who live in an association, and you want, or you have a vacation home in an association. You can include all of that here. All right, final thing. Is this helpful to you? Would you like to see more information like this from the HOA Ombudsman Office? If so, tell us, because we want to make sure that we're providing good information for the public. And so, yeah, tell us if this is helpful to you. That's essentially it. Chris, do we have any other questions that we didn't get to that we want to go back to?
Yeah, we got a couple we can go through. We've had a few that have come in about minutes. Are
Okay.
there requirements for what info needs to be included in board meeting minutes?
Yeah, that's a great question. Not according to state statute. There might be some things in your governing documents. They need to be thorough enough. I would encourage you to go talk to your attorneys about making sure that your minutes are good. We will, when we get into the section on minutes on our website, we have some templates that you can use as a guide, and download and use, but they're pretty flexible.
Okay, let's find another. On the record turnover guidelines, there's a few questions about do these apply retroactively? As in, can an association request outstanding records not yet transferred within the last 3 years from a prior management company?
That is a great question. That's a great question. I don't know the answer to that yet. Talk to an attorney.
And then I think one final question that's come up a few times about reserve studies and how can people know if their reserves are being funded like they're supposed to and what the amounts should be and things like that.
So the budget includes a line item for the reserves, and every homeowner in the community has the right to see the reserve analysis or the reserve study. In fact, the association has to provide that, I think, every year to the association. An association has to do a new reserve study every 6 years, and then every 3 years they check it out, update it if they need to. But a homeowner can request that at any time. So, as a homeowner, that's part of your responsibility, right? Is to make sure that you're looking at what does the reserve study tell us that we need? What is actually being accounted for in the budget? And do those things match up? Some associations prefer to use special assessments to keep the dues low. The reality of living in an HOA, though, is that you should expect your annual assessments to increase somewhat regularly. If they're not, you may be in a position where your reserve fund starts to get too low. And that is a concern that we have as an office, that we have a number of underfunded HOAs. And you don't want to be in a position where you end up having to levy a $65,000 special assessment against everyone in your community who may or may not be able to pay it. There's a trade-off here. Boards have some discretion. The standard is prudence. So a board has to be prudent in deciding how much they allocate to reserves every year. But there are a lot of consequences to your association being underfunded. So it's a good conversation to have every year in your annual meeting when the board is presenting the budget.
Okay. And then we have several questions asking about what is considered capital intensive infrastructure and what can those reinvestment fees actually be used for?
So again, I will encourage you to talk to your association attorney to get real specific on this. The basic idea is things like, again, roads or pools or roofs or clubhouses, right? They're the big things, the big common areas, the amenities, the big infrastructure. If you have a water meter that feeds the entire community, things like that are likely going to be capital intensive. Infrastructure. So usually that's what reserves are designed to go for. But for real specific information there, I'll encourage you to talk to your attorneys.
Okay, and then how can homeowners and real estate agents find out if the transfer or reinvestment fees that are recorded are proper or if they are, it would fall under that wrongful lien?
Yeah, you'll definitely want to consult an attorney in that case. A property attorney.
I think that's time.
Okay. It looks like we might have some questions about, what can small associations do if they can't afford an attorney? These are complex enough that having legal counsel should probably be part of your budget. So, if you have questions, feel free to call us. We can't provide specific legal advice as a state office. That's not really part of our jurisdiction, but we can tell you what the state code says and then go from there. But if you have questions, if you want and need legal advice, it's probably worth having a discussion as a community about allocating some funds to attorney's fees. And I guess that's probably it. So, pretty overwhelming response for additional future HOA webinars. That's great to know. We will consider this. We have a whole bunch of stuff that's happening here in the office. There are three of us, as you saw, plus our intern, who is fantastic. And so we're going to do the best we can to get you as much information as humanly possible. But it might take a little bit of time. So be patient with us. We will give you as much information as we can. Thank you all so much for joining this webinar. I hope that it was helpful for you. If you have additional questions, if we didn't get to your specific question, again, feel free to reach out to us and we would be more than happy to assist you in the future. So thanks everyone for joining. Have a great night and we will talk to you all later.